Hello and welcome to the Contemplations of the Lotus Eaters. I'm Hugo and I'm here with Josh.
Hello.
And this is a show where we're not necessarily focusing on current events, but we take a topic that we think is interesting and might be valuable to you, and we talk about it in depth and we see what comes out of it. And so today we're continuing our discussion from yesterday, which was about psychology of personality and how it affects politics and political preferences, and we'll be talking about the dark side of this, which is the dark triad and kind of the personal characteristics that I connected to it. And Josh knows about it, I don't, and so this is going to be interesting.
That's all right. So it's actually not very complicated, but it's nice to have the research to kind of back up what people would already think. Like, it may not necessarily be a surprise, although there are some interesting findings that are counterintuitive in this. But nevertheless, I would like to get onto a research paper which has been suggested to me several times. I feel like it's about time I actually cover it, which is a research paper known as Signaling Virtuous Victimhood as an Indicator of the Triad Personalities. And this is by a whole host of authors that I cannot pronounce, but I'm going to give it a go anyway, just for humour's sake. So it's Ok Xian and Stresic Aquiano, and they're all from the University of British Columbia.
Sounded all good. I mean,
that's uncharacteristically good for me.
All right.
So it's worth mentioning what the actual dark triad is first before we get into the virtuous victimhood and the signals that are associated with it. So the dark triad is made up of three things, as you can probably imagine. The first being narcissism, which is characterized by grandiosity, pride, egotism, and a lack of empathy, which I think most people are familiar with the term narcissism. It doesn't mean anything different, really, in the realm of psychology when compared with, anywhere else.
Yeah.
And then there's also Machiavellianism, which is characterized by manipulation and exploitation of others in the absence of morality, unemotional callousness, and a higher level of self-interest than perhaps is the norm.
Poor Machiavelli, he was such a good Republican and he gets such a bad rap.
I feel like Machiavelli gets really thrown under the bus in the Dark Triad, but his actual thoughts aren't as insidious as they kind of presented here. But I get what it's trying to say in
Of course.
It's being strategic and working behind the scenes to press your advantage, right? And I think Machiavellianism is just the kind of lay term for people's understanding.
Although it's easy to understand even if you don't really know the background or anything. So.
Exactly. And perhaps far more kind of consistent between the psychological usage and the kind of lay usage is psychopathy.
Which is the third one, right?
It is indeed, yeah. Which is characterized by continuous antisocial behavior, impulsivity, selfishness, callous and unemotional traits, and remorselessness. As you can probably imagine what a psychopath would be like, you know, it's not beyond the realm of imagination.
And so when we're talking about psychopathy, what's the difference between psychopathy and sociopathy, if there's any, or if it's clearly defined?
I think, although I'm not a clinical psychologist, I believe the difference is that a psychopath cannot pick up on people's like emotional signals, whereas a sociopath can still identify these kind of emotions in other people. They just don't care.
Right. Okay.
So I think that's the distinction, or at least one of the main ones that I was taught, but I'm certainly no expert in this. So,
But yeah, like this is going to be focused on psychopathy out of the, like, that's one of the three, so that's going to be the important one.
Yeah. So in the study, a factor analysis found that out of the big five personality traits, which we covered yesterday, which is things such as agreeableness, extroversion, openness to experience, conscientiousness, neuroticism. I think that's all five, isn't it? So out of those, the most predictive of having these dark triad traits was low agreeableness, which was the strongest correlate to the dark triad, while neuroticism and lack of conscientiousness were also associated with some of the dark triad traits as well.
So OpenSNX Draw version, that's not really so relevant. If you low on those, doesn't necessarily mean that the dark thread is something that you need to worry about.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So people scoring high on these traits are more likely to commit crimes, and by these traits I mean the dark triad, more likely to commit crimes, cause social distress, create severe problems in like a workplace or an organization, especially if they're in some kind of leadership position. And there's a whole kind of expansive literature in how you can deal with these people in the workplace, which I find interesting that it's such a problem that people have gone out and researched it. I don't know whether that's just a problem specific to academics, but it seemed relatively bizarre to me. Just on a side note, that's a discipline in and of itself.
I mean, I don't know, maybe you'll get into it, how many people like that there actually are, or with how many people that is the problem. And so if you have a large enough workspace, you're bound to have one or two people that are like that, and then they're going to create a toxic environment or something like that. Like if you have 50 people, maybe one of them will be something like that. And so then you need to have some ways to go around it and kind of solve the situation, make it better.
Mm-hmm. I know that the figure that's often bandied around about psychopathy is about 1% of the population is, but I haven't actually looked at how they've arrived at that. And there's kind of the question of, would people be up front and be like, yeah, I'm a psychopath, so they can get an accurate measure of this. Like, it seems to me that a trait of being a psychopath is that you're not going to go around telling people that you are one.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so is that with the Big Five, the people that developed the Big Five, they developed a test, and then according to the test, they crunched the numbers, crunched the answers, and they have these five axes on which they rank you. Is it how that works in the dark triad as well? So do they have a test which then you take, and then you'll get a score on those three?
I believe so. I haven't actually taken the test personally, not because of any fear that I'm gonna score highly on any of them, but just because I haven't had the time to do it. But it's more or less the same, although it wasn't quite the large-scale collaborative effort that it was in the Big Five. So whereas the Big Five can be regarded as very reliable as far as psychometric tests go, the Dark Triad is perhaps less reliable, but also, you know, it seems to be getting at tangible things. And you don't necessarily need to be a data scientist to know that these three things are traits that people can have. And that they're identifiable by kind of thoughts and behaviours.
Right.
Like you can rely on anecdote more than you might actually think, because in interacting with people face to face all the time, that's collecting data in and of itself, right?
Yep.
So you can use that as a general intuition. Can't speak English anymore. Then direct your research from that. And I think that's what's happened here, where people have identified this tendency in people, and then through their kind of anecdotal experiences, they've developed these measures.
It would be interesting. I mean, we can do that after, and the viewers can do it as well, to take both tests, the Big Five test and then this Dark Triad test, and see whether it actually works for them in the way that you said, that that openness and extroversion have nothing to do with it. Basically, those can be random, and then the rest is kind of moving with it, or the opposite, right?
I mean, I kind of don't want to take it, because I'm worried I might get a high score on something.
No. Yeah, I have to do it on camera.
I'm gonna do it and conceal it like a true psychopath. No, I'm only joking, of course. So
that's what a psychopath would say.
Anyway, moving on. I'm gonna get on to how this paper defines modern victimhood. So
let's take a step back.
Okay,
because
sure.
You said that this test, this paper, lays out the dark triad. Is it the one that defines it or came up with it, or is it
No. It's
a different one? Is the one that takes it and applies to something else?
This is one that's applying it to something else,
okay.
But it's a pre-existing thing.
Okay,
that
I understand. Yep.
Is like another test of personality that's been developed kind of in collaboration with lots of researchers, but not to the same extent as the Big Five. Like the Big Five is one of the kind of shining examples of what psychologists can do when they work together on something over a number of years, like 20, 30 years, and get this really kind of cohesive and reliable test that seems to be consistent, at least in comparison to most of the others in existence. It's kind of comparable to that of an IQ test.
Yep. It's just that I wasn't sure whether this was the seminal text for the Dark Triad or whether it was its application to something else.
No, no. If I go back to the title, it's applying the Dark Triad to signaling virtuous victimhood. So what it's saying is, if you perceive yourself or present yourself as a victim, it's also looking at how people present themselves as virtuous, because if you're a victim and you're virtuous, if you signal out that you are a virtuous victim, well, it seems like the world has been cruel to you, because you've done nothing wrong, you're virtuous, but you're a victim, therefore it kind of signals that you deserve some kind of recompense for your misfortune, which we will get onto now.
So it takes these three kind of features in society or characteristics that people might have that we can observe around us in some people, and then they look at how they correlate with the Dark Triad, right? That's the gist of it. Okay, I understand now. Sorry about the interruption.
That's all right. Yeah. So I think everyone's familiar with the term virtue signaling, aren't they? So that's what it's predicated on, and it's interesting that it's like an identifiable thing in the scientific literature that, you know, this thing we've been using anecdotally in the kind of anti-social justice sphere, where we're saying, oh, they're just virtue signaling, and now it's actually a thing that exists.
They're not just virtue signaling. They are virtue signaling. You know, it's a scientific term.
Yeah, it's science. Trust the science, guys.
Trust the expert, who's definitely not a psychopath. I'm going to stop bullying you now.
Hang on a minute. If you keep on bullying me, doesn't that make you the psychopath? Anyway, right. So normally victimhood carries a lot of negative baggage, and there's lots of results of being a victim that are tangible and real, and I don't necessarily want to demean those. People can get PTSD, be very distressed, fearful, anxious. They can lose self-esteem, loss of trust of the people around them. And they can have a heightened sense of vulnerability. And these are all real tangible things, and they're not necessarily indicative of any manipulative behavior. That's just how people seem to react to being a genuine victim. And in a Western society, we've, according to the authors of this study, embraced a culture of victimhood, which I would agree with, in that there's some degree of virtue in being a victim in the modern day.
So when is this from, the study?
Last year.
Okay.
2020.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was June 2020, I think.
Right.
And claiming one as being a victim is increasingly advantageous, and they state it's even fashionable to claim that you're a victim. I don't know, it's quite gone that far yet, but I kind of see what they're getting at, in that in political circles in particular, claiming that you're a victim or something, or you're oppressed, seems to elevate your status, in that you're able to talk about things which other people might not. And that's kind of what I think they might be getting at there.
With this specific point, I don't think they're exaggerating. I think it is fashionable, or to be more precise, I think it was fashionable a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It's starting to become less fashionable now, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I think that's a fair word to use there.
I think people who haven't been following the kind of culture debate in politics, even they've picked up on this kind of...
It's annoying.
Yeah, it is annoying, because it's just people whinging, basically.
It's weak, feeble.
Need to read some stoicism, that's what they need to do. So there's nothing to suggest that... even people sharing their experience is necessarily bad, because it can help connect them with other people who've had similar experiences and help provide support and validation to the genuine victims. So I don't want people to take this research and bully people who've been genuinely victimized and are just looking for support. Like, it just because they're reaching out doesn't mean they're virtue signaling and therefore a psychopath or have these dark triad traits. So I just want to be very clear that you do need to be nice to people who are victims. That's not something a psychopath would say, is it now? And the actual validation and support can actually lead to changes in the person's behavior, and we found this, and it does actually seem to work. So that there are perfectly valid reasons for people to do this before I get onto the kind of darker side of it.
And so for the people that are actual victim of something, you can work with it in some ways, I don't know, therapy or something like that, and then you can overcome that sense of victimhood, and therefore then these traits go away, basically, because you stop being a victim and you stop feeling like that.
I mean, you can still be a victim and not necessarily get to a clinical level either. Like, you can, I don't know, someone could come up to you and like steal some money from you, and it might be inconvenient in the moment, but you might it might not have any long-term effects on you, and you're like, well, that's kind of annoying, it's pretty unfortunate, but it's not necessarily going to change who you are in some people. So I don't also want to emphasize that not being affected is a bad thing either. You know, there's no true or proportionate response, it's just how you deal with it, which is a very subjective and wishy-washy thing to say, but it's always better for you to be able to deal with something well, but don't necessarily feel bad if you can't. And with all those caveats out the way, this research looked at consequences that predictors of emitting signals of victimhood and virtue, that was phrased really badly, but they looked at things that could predict whether people could emit signals of their victimhood and whether they were virtuous and deserving of some degree of recompense. And they did this in a series of six studies in which, in each of the studies, they recruited a kind of a significant number of participants, at least around 300, 400, if not more in some cases.
And so what did they do? You said that they measured whether those people felt like victims or whether they behaved like...
So they had... Each of the experiments was very different. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dwell on the actual methodology too much of each of them, but I will mention it kind of in passing. Mm-hmm. But if you are interested, we're going to link the research paper down below, and you can actually look at the methodology of the paper and kind of see it for yourself rather than me just reading out what you can probably read just as well. But
So you said that they were looking at people's victimhood and also their sense of virtuousness, but how were they measuring it, or how were they looking at what is actually true and what is actually just their perception or their pretense of something? I know how I would go about doing these things, and I don't know how this research was done, so I'm curious.
I think generally you can generate a psychometric scale to measure pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And as long as you can get kind of replicable results and, you know, signaling virtue and victimhood and stuff, this has been in the literature for, you know, the past 5 years. So I'm not sure whether they came up with the scale themselves or someone else, because I didn't actually look at the kind of material side of the research paper. I just looked at the methodology and their results, because I kind of understand how these scales are derived and know that for it to be published in a prominent paper, they're going to rely on someone using a kind of valid, reliable, replicable scale.
And so they were...
It would just be self-reported measures, that sort of thing.
And so they would have some self-reported answers, and those would give them some measure of virtue that the person has. And what does that mean? I mean, I don't really know what I can imagine.
In the case of one of their experiments, it's just they gave people a scenario.
But not just what they did to the people, but what it means when they say, okay, you've got virtue and you're 55 on that. Like, what?
It's like in some of the experiments, which I didn't want to get into, but... They gave people a scenario, and depending on whether the person was deserving of the victimhood or not, So it's like whether they've done something. So they're not necessarily talking about virtue in the Aristotelian sense.
Right. Okay,
in a very complicated scenario. But if their victimhood is undeserved or not,
it's useful to think of it in
those terms.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, like undeserved or deserved victimhood. Yeah, that makes... It just clicked in my head, like what you actually meant, rather than just like how they define virtue, what that is. You know, like,
I think that's a huge rabbit hole. I mean, I can talk about what defines it, but I'll be here for about a few hours. But so anyway, back to the actual study. Mm-hmm. It operates under the theory that modern victim signaling is about non-reciprocal resource extraction from either institutions or individuals that are more resource rich than themselves.
Okay.
So it's all about getting things either...
Because you're a victim.
Yeah. Yep. So these things can either be material or symbolic. In the material category, as you can imagine, it'd be money, jobs and access to education, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in the symbolic, it's like respect, tolerance and compassion. Mm-hmm. And the research suggested in the series of six studies that dark triad traits... those who scored highly in those more frequently signaled the virtuous victimhood in their sample of Western societies. Mm-hmm. And out of the three dark triad traits, Machiavellianism is correlated most highly, then it's psychopathy, and then it's narcissism.
Okay, so it's more like they're doing it on purpose.
Yeah, like it's a real strategy
for
people to extract.
So you might look at those people and wonder sometimes whether they're kind of ignorant or whether they don't know what they're doing, but they're still doing it because something's wrong, or whether it's a plan to achieve something. And you're saying that it's more correlated to with Machiavellianism, which would indicate that it's more likely to be, or more often...
Deliberate, yeah.
Like, to be deliberate. Mm-hmm. It's a conscious strategy to do something.
Not only that, but also psychopathy as well, which means... that even the second most correlated trait is associated with it, and narcissism is third. Mm-hmm. And that still had some weaker correlation, but it wasn't as strong as the others. Yeah. And if it was coming from a genuine place where they actually believed what they said and they were just really self-centered, then narcissism would be the thing to look at.
Yep, yep.
So what they're... What they suggested was some people will repeatedly admit the signal of virtuous victimhood in an opportunistic manner to initiate these non-reciprocal resource transfers. Mm-hmm. So they will employ it as a strategy to get resources, be it psychological or otherwise. So I'd just like to take a quote here, talking about the actual studies they did themselves. They say, "Our first three studies demonstrate how a perceived victim signal can lead others to transfer resources to a victim, but that the motivation to do so is amplified when the victim signal is paired with a virtue signal."
Okay.
So that goes back to the discussion we had earlier, where I was saying that it's whether they are a deserving victim or not.
Right.
And in virtue signaling, it means that they are deserving of the resources that they are after.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, at least in some people's perception.
So it's interesting that that was the case, that Machiavellianism and psychopathy were the ones more correlated with it, because that kind of denies, in this case, or overcomes the Hanlon's razor, if like, which is... never ascribed to malice what can be ascribed to incompetence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So something like that. And so in this case, you could say, okay, they might be just stupid or something, or they might be just really self-centered. It might not necessarily be malice, but then this says that no, like in this case, this is not true. It actually is quite malice more often than not.
I generally do subscribe to the incompetence over malice, but I found it very... kind of interesting that this went against that, even though generally speaking I try and give people the benefit of the doubt. And that
it's not like it's a rule. It's a thing that you should kind of employ if you don't have any other information, but if you have other information, of course that's more useful.
And just to kind of bring in another point, those who are higher in the dark triad traits also signaled more often of their victimhood and virtuousness.
Right.
So the higher they scored on these traits, the more that they would signal mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to go through another quote here. So in study 3, we showed that more frequent virtuous victim signalers are more willing to purchase counterfeit products and judge counterfeiters as less immoral compared with less frequent signalers, a pattern that was also observed when using participants' dark triad scores instead of their signaling scores. So this is one of the cases where they're looking mm-hmm. At their morality in a sense.
Okay.
So, they're testing the findings of these participants that they found to be scoring highly in these dark triad scores, and they've also taken out the signaling score that they've derived and replaced it with the dark triad score, and the mm-hmm. same pattern still emerges that they're more likely to purchase these counterfeit products, which is kind of suggesting that they're more willing to be deceptive because it's in the case of counterfeiting something, it's giving off a kind of a status signal, isn't it? Like mm-hmm. they probably, I think there's the example of women getting like counterfeit Gucci handbags and stuff like that, where it's not really the real deal, but it looks like the real deal. And the deception there is all about gaining status, which is undue.
Okay, yeah, it makes sense.
And they also found that frequent virtuous victim signalers were more likely to cheat and lie to earn extra monetary rewards in a coin flip game as well.
Right, yep.
So it's not necessarily that it's just about the virtue signaling for the resources. Mm-hmm. They found in lots of other domains where these dark triad traits would come into play, that they're also consistently siding on the dishonest, lying to get ahead sort of mm-hmm. side that you'd expect just if you were looking at the dark triad and its correlation with other things. And these studies have been relatively replicable, mm-hmm. and you can kind of rely on that a bit more than perhaps this newer study, but I still think it's interesting. And they've also gone through, you know, in 6 studies and tested and retested these various assumptions to predicate their conclusions on something that is at least been kind of tested in a cohesive manner, and alternative explanations can be ruled out.
Right. And so what they did was to say, yeah, there's these dark triad traits, mm-hmm. and these people that are high in this virtue signaling and victimhood, mm-hmm. like those people, that's correlated with the dark triad. Mm-hmm. And if you take those people that are high on both of them and look at what they do, they also tend to lie and lie to earn extra monetary reward and cheat mm-hmm. and things like that, right? That's if I'm understanding that correctly.
In kind of data science, we might say that the dark triad in that case is a mediating mm-hmm. factor in that it explains the root cause of a behavior. So yep. if you were to draw, kind of you'd have the virtue signaling in one box, and then you could draw a line and say kind of the dishonest deceiving to get the resources, but you can also have a line that goes to this separate box mm-hmm. where it would be the mediating factor of the dark triad, where if it goes through that way, it can explain it just as well as if yep. it were the yep. line straight to there.
Okay, makes sense.
And I lost where I was now. Communal narcissism was also a significant and positive predictor for the frequency of virtuous victimhood. So rather than individual narcissism, it's narcissism in a collective sense, which I think is more to do with your group. And you can see perhaps where it might be getting at here, because they controlled for things like socioeconomic background and a person's ethnicity. And just in controlling for these factors in their explanations, you can kind of work backwards to say, well, they expected these things to have an effect, mm-hmm. but they didn't actually. And I think the reason they controlled for the ethnicity is because it might be relating to what we see now in perhaps US and the UK, where people from certain ethnic communities are signaling their kind of victimhood and what they're implicating kind of in a very soft way is that perhaps there's some kind of communal narcissism rather than individual, although the individual can harbor that. It's more about the community validating this sense.
And so how, I don't understand how they arrive at this conclusion or how they measure it even, because you said that they controlled for things like ethnicity and socioeconomic background, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did, and they expected it to have an impact, but it didn't, or did? Because what I'm thinking is that...
It would be on an individual level, I'm saying. But
right. It is
an explanation at the communal level. When they perceive their peers, so to speak, mm-hmm. then narcissism plays more of a role. But when it's just them as an individual, then it's not so important.
Okay. So my kind of sense or like a guess of how it works mm-hmm. from what I've seen is that this behavior, this kind of virtue-seeking signaling behavior mm-hmm. is not necessarily widespread in any community, ethnicity or anything like mm-hmm. that, but it's individuals that are often quite loud and that in these cases pretend to speak for some group of people, right?
Sure, there's certainly some element of that, but they don't exist in a vacuum. I mean, there's some perceived group of people that surrounds them, and I feel like it's generated by some kind of sense of group belonging, maybe, mm-hmm. rather than like these people wouldn't be so comfortable signaling their virtue if it was just them alone doing it, because it would seem like
it's them doing it, so the difference is they're not doing it on behalf of themselves but on behalf of others.
Not necessarily. In the
I'm having the trouble to understand, sorry about that.
So I'll just read out what okay. I've got here again. So communal narcissism was a significant predictor for the frequency of signaling virtuous victimhood. So
yeah, but what's communal narcissism? That's the thing. I don't understand what that is.
It's kind of narcissism based in a group perception. So it's a group's view of itself.
Yeah, but that's what I was saying. Is that you're doing virtue signaling, and you're not saying I'm a victim and I deserve these resources, mm-hmm. but this group that I'm representing is the victim and they deserve the resources, including me, because I'm part of it.
I think just to be clear, it's obviously the individual being questions perception mm-hmm. of the community. So it could be that if they're a particularly kind of dark triad scoring person, then they're going to perceive the support within the community as being far greater than it otherwise would be, or at least give out the outward perception of that. And because they're interviewing individuals, it's just simply that the community might be the justification mm-hmm. for why they're doing it. It's not necessarily clear in a cause and effect sense why it would be, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I was just wondering what like phrase communal narcissism, what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I understand a bit better now that it's that narcissism, but that is motivated by a sense of belonging in the group. And that's like, this is what,
mm-hmm.
where it comes from. It's not something that comes from a sense of pride and mm-hmm. self-centeredness in your own person.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in like an example, it would be people who are in Bristol demanding reparations. Like they're saying they represent a group.
Right.
And they're trying to extract resources, even though, you know, they're probably kind of emigrating from the 1950s to Britain, nothing to do with slavery in the slightest,
mm-hmm.
but because they feel like this group belonging, they feel like they're deserving of something.
Right, yep, okay.
And I'd like to take out another quote quickly. Together, our studies present the converging evidence that virtuous victimhood signaling, is an effective mechanism for persuading others to part with their resources in a way that benefits the signaler, and that people who tend to engage in amoral social manipulation achieve their goals in a way which makes them more likely to omit them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just saying that they're effective at that because people buy it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the last thing I'd like to read out from their kind of conclusions is, we strongly caution against this interpretation of our findings in the uncritical categorization of people as being good or bad, depending on whether they are publicly communicating their suffering or misfortune.
Yeah, so that's what you're saying in the beginning. They
exactly.
might be actual victims.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I just wanted to reiterate that I also feel the same way, that just because someone is a victim and communicating it doesn't mean they're trying to do this. And I don't want people to go out and accuse actual victims of things as being self-interested and just trying to get resources, because that's unethical in and of itself. And, you know, you've got to give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. But there's obviously this kind of different phenomenon, which is these people just like soliciting money from you just because they can. Because they know that this works.
Yeah, and it really does work. Like, you get... there's the picture of the absolutely massive woman with that green kind of suit on, and she's just like, white people are racist. Now here's my PayPal. Like, it's so transparent. And that's the perfect... That's the perfect example of... what they're trying to get at where they're claiming to be a victim and then blatantly just trying to get money out of it. So on to something that is a little bit less contemporary, I suppose. It's not so much a problem anymore, which is looking at personality and prejudice. And this is a meta-analysis, which, to reiterate, is an analysis of lots of pre-existing studies. In this case, it is 71 studies, and it sampled a total of 22,000 people.
That's what.
So yeah, it's a pretty reliable kind of metric for the conclusions of an entire field of research. And this was conducted by Sibley and Duckett from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And they looked at things such as right-wing authoritarianism and its association with the personality, the big five personality constructs, and prejudice. So right-wing authoritarianism is predicted by low openness to experience but high conscientiousness.
So that's reiterating what we were talking about yesterday, really,
but in the extreme.
Right.
And the effect of low openness to experience is mediated through right-wing authoritarianism. So I know I touched on mediation earlier, but it's a statistical thing where the relationship between low openness and kind of people's political views, that is mediated through this kind of construct of right-wing authoritarianism.
And so this construct, how do they define it? What's in it? Or do they take like an example of like an analysis?
That's pretty much it. This kind of understanding is rooted in the study of personality and politics that I was talking about in the kind of first half of the yesterday's episode, where the studies are rooted in trying to understand the actions in World War II, and that's kind of what they define. Like, they kind of...
Right. So it's quite straightforward. There's nothing like elaborate. It's saying, okay, look, here are the Nazis, these are the right-wing authoritarians, and this is how we're going to... Right, yep.
So the mediation model seeks to identify and explain mechanisms or processes that underlie an observed relationship between an independent variable and a dependent variable via the inclusion of a third hypothetical variable. So I've wrote this out in far clearer terms just to... of make it as clear as possible, because it's a bit difficult to explain on the fly. So I've made sure to type it out, and I forgot I did that, so I probably should have included that earlier. There's also something known as social dominance orientation, which is a personality trait measuring an individual's support for social hierarchy and the extent to which they desire their in-group to be superior to the out-group.
Okay.
And I kind of have a little bit of an issue with this, because you can be supportive of a social hierarchy, but then also not favour an in-group.
Yeah.
And I feel like conflating the two kind of...
But are they? Or are they saying that the combination of those two means that you're right and authoritarian?
Yeah, well, but in constructing the social dominance orientation, they're putting two things together, which I might question whether they need to co-occur together.
Okay, but so they would say that if they do, they would be a predictor of something, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and so, but they're not saying that they have to.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
And they said this social dominance orientation was predicted by low agreeableness and also weakly by low openness. So this is your willingness to support both social hierarchy and favouring an in-group to an out-group. And they also found that in the domain of social dominance orientation, that the effect of agreeableness on a kind of out-group prejudice is mediated through this effect, in that it can be explained through this kind of social dominance orientation, or this construct, where they suggest that these two things of supporting a social hierarchy in which you favour your in-group over an out-group is the root cause of prejudice, essentially. And I think that's relatively reasonable, to be honest, because even if you take a kind of step back and just think about it logically, if you're going to favour your in-group over an out-group, you're going to have some understanding of a social hierarchy, aren't you? Because you're ranking these two groups above or below one another, and therefore you're going to have an understanding of hierarchy. So it seems relatively intuitive that preferring an in-group to an out-group is going to have this relationship with that. It's not really surprising, but it's nice to have the research to validate that understanding.
It's a necessary condition of it, right? Because without having a sense of hierarchy, you can't say that you have an in-group preference, because that's hierarchy.
Exactly, yeah. So although this is kind of something that you notice a lot in psychology, because it's still only, you know, the actual scientific approach is only about 150 years old. It's just looking at lots of things that people kind of understand already, but they're just trying to validate whether they're observable and truthful or not.
Yep. Oh, that makes sense.
And the final thing that I thought would be interesting to look at.
I remember that I was, I wanted to ask something before. Did you look into how this right-wing authoritarianism or social dominance orientation, how they, what do they have in common with the dark triad, or how do they interplay with it? Because they looked at the Big Five, and that was the measuring stick for that. But what about the dark triad?
I didn't actually look at research into that, but I would imagine that, particularly for the right-wing authoritarianism, there might be some degree of correlation with perhaps psychopathy. Like you have cases of prominent Nazis where they killed people without remorse, and you kind of have to think in those terms to be able to do something like that. And perhaps for the social dominance orientation, I would perhaps expect there to be some degree of correlation with the narcissism element of the dark triad, because you're placing yourself and your group above other people, and that's got to involve some degree of self-centeredness, right?
Yep. So that's your hypothesis of what it might be.
Yeah.
But it's not something necessarily that you found in any research that has already been done.
I didn't really look for it, actually. Okay. I wanted to look at lots of different areas just to give people an idea of what research exists, and so they could navigate it more easily. And there's, because I'm covering the dark side of politics, I didn't want to go too deeply into any one area and give people a brief overview. But I'm sure the research probably does exist.
What you said now, like, I mean, that makes intuitive sense to me. Like, that's how it could be. That's what it feels like would be right.
Yeah.
Even though I don't have it confirmed right in front of me, right?
So. Sure. But it would certainly be something interesting to look at, and I'm probably going to have to go away and look now you've brought it up, because you've sparked my curiosity.
Okay. Also, let's move to the last one now.
Sure. Yep. So this last paper I thought was interesting, because this is very counterintuitive and goes against what I was saying earlier, that psychology is just validating what people already kind of believe. But it's called A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of the Psychological Literature on Conspiracy Beliefs, Field Characteristics, Measurement Instruments, and Association with Personality Traits. So what they did was they looked at 96 different studies that used 13 different questionnaire measures on conspiracy theory beliefs. And in openness experience, openness to experience, this pool of participants resulted in about 5,000 people in agreeableness. It was 10,000, conscientiousness 11,000, extroversion 6,000, and neuroticism 11,500. Mm-hmm. So that's a very large pool of participants to make conclusions about. And they found basically the correlation with each of them was very close to zero, which means that it seems like there's very little relationship. And also, when they ran statistical tests of significance, it was pretty much insignificant in all cases. Mm-hmm. So they actually found that there's no personality trait that would predict someone's tendency to be conspiratorial. Mm-hmm. And you'd think that perhaps neuroticism would be at least in part related, right? In that perhaps you'd think of someone who's very high in anxiety, for example, might be more prone to believing that everyone's out to get them, and therefore they're more likely to believe in conspiracy. But they didn't find any correlation whatsoever in all of the studies of it.
Maybe if you're high in openness, you're intrigued by Yetis.
Wait, intrigued by Yetis, did you say? I am high in openness, and exactly. I am intrigued by them.
Exactly. See?
I want to believe.
You've disproved this study.
It's not a conspiracy, though. I'm just...
Fair enough. But it would be, right, if they tried to cover it up.
Well, they don't necessarily have to have covered it up. They might not have just found one, you know? It's still fine. I mean, being realistic, there probably isn't such a thing, but kind of the idea of believing it is funny to me. Therefore, I kind of want to believe it just for the comedy value of it. But to go back to actual serious stuff, it seems bizarre to me that there's no correlation between personality, mm-hmm. because I think there exists a stereotype of the kind of person who really buys into conspiracy theories, right? And people assume that there's some kind of personal problems that underlie their beliefs a lot of the time when they're dismissing them, but it doesn't seem to be the case, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I wouldn't expect that. I would expect it to be at least to some extent correlated, even... Mm-hmm. Even more so when I would expect that the people actually looking into this are not necessarily friendly to those who are interested in conspiracy theories, right? So I would expect them to be, you know, at least a little bit trying to find something.
Yeah, and the only
kind of... I'm not saying that they're not honest or anything. It's just that there's this tendency sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine that if they're carrying out a meta-analysis, this is like... years of work. It's mm-hmm. not something that you do very easily, and especially going through 96 studies, that's a lot of hard work. So they're not going to flippantly do this just to be like, yeah, nothing to it. So I feel like they've just in the sheer amount of work they would have put in, they're going to treat it with due respect. Mm-hmm. And the only explanation for perhaps them being mistaken that I can think of is that out of the 96 studies, there were 13 different questionnaire measures, which means that there could be a lot of noise in the data.
Would have needed to like make them converge in some ways to put them on one scale, right?
And
five scales.
That would probably be the most difficult aspect of this for them. And it might not necessarily be that they did something with any bad intentions, but it could be that they maybe made a mistake somewhere in kind of making these 13 measures come into some kind of cohesive whole, mm-hmm. but it is difficult to tell. You know, it's such an expansive thing that one person just looking at the study, even if you read it from start to finish, you're not going to be able to tell this sort of thing. And that's perhaps one criticism of meta-analyses, is that they're so complicated that just a single reader reading through it, unless you're kind of a senior academic that's been doing these for, you know, your entire career, you're not really going to be able to pick up on markers of where they might have gone wrong, because it's just so there's so much information there, it's kind of beyond comprehension.
And so you said that the main kind of potential weak point, even though there's no reason to believe that they did something wrong, is that there's 13 different questionnaires, mm-hmm. but there's 96 studies, so there has to be at least one questionnaire for which there are at least seven studies. And so you could take seven studies or more, probably more, of one questionnaire, and then that would be much more solid in that way. You would just you would just crunch the numbers, and you would need to do the subjective work of kind of converging these questionnaires together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm kind of being a bit nitpicky to say that if there were a problem, that might be where it would arise.
Yeah,
but
no,
generally speaking, you can take these at face value because the amount of work that goes in, they're not going to be amateur researchers. They're going to be well aware of the work that goes into it. And I've worked with academics on meta-analyses and going through the research papers, and you pick out the key statistics that you can kind of bring into a cohesive whole, and some that might otherwise be interesting you may have to disregard just because they're not shared in common with lots of the other research. So there's kind of a sifting through of the data that is very tedious and takes a long time, but it seems to come up with interesting results in the end.
So this whole discussion with the last few minutes was just to say that this is a result that is robust and quite reliable. It's done well. It's not something that was done hastily or something that wouldn't be something that would be just someone talking out of their backside.
Yeah, I mean, going through 96 studies, that's no small order. I imagine that that's taken thousands of hours, if not more, and with a team of researchers. So it's not just something that people would do flippantly.
Right. Well, that was really interesting. I mean, the kind of dark side of personality and how it might correlate with politics and the Big Five and the Dark Triad and everything like that. So thank you for that.
That's okay.
Right. And so if you like this episode, make sure to go to lotuseeders.com, where we have all of our content, all of the other contemplations episodes, and we have articles and premium content, interviews, everything. And so if you want to support us, you can become a premium member there. And if you wouldn't like to support us, you can do it anyway. And so thank you for watching and see you next time.
Goodbye.